Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. The UK general practice has reached crisis point. The impact of the COVID-19 pandemic has placed a strain on an already crumbling primary care service, leaving both patients and NHS staff struggling. In this episode, Dr. Ellen Welch and Dr. Niat Arif lift the curtain on general practice, reflecting on the history of the profession, how it's changed, and what its future might look like. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, hear accounts from GPs as they consider, how did we get here? Is it better overseas? And what can be done to make things better?
Good morning. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for giving up your Saturday. I'm Dr. Niat Arif, and I've got my wonderful colleague, Dr. Ellen Welch. And today we're going to be answering this question, why can't I see my GP? We're going to do a round of introductions, and then we're going to talk about the issues that we have in general practice. And then particularly we'll be ending on one of the biggest areas that I love to talk a lot about, which is women's health, because we both are authors and we've got our books out. And so we're going to leave the latter half of this as a Q&A, because I won't ask you as many questions, but you can ask us as many questions as possible. So just to kickstart off at proceedings this morning, I'm just going to note the fact that this is the quickest you'll see your GP, all right? I get it. I understand things aren't as great at the moment. And as always, we come like buses. You'll get two GPs for the price of one this morning. So think of all those questions that you want to ask us. Who am I? Well, I'm Dr. Niat. I'm a GP who doesn't work in Bradford. I'm based in Buckinghamshire, just outside of London. And I came here at the age of 9 and learnt how to speak English. And being the first member of my family to learn English from Pakistan, that's where I came from at the age of 9, I ended up translating for my mother. And before I knew it, I was translating periods and menopause and women's health issues and heart attacks and strokes. So it was only natural that I progressed into becoming a doctor later on. And then I decided that I wanted to be a GP. I work with a lot of predominantly South Asian community. So I'm very close to Slough. If anyone's heard of wonderful Slough, just to let you know, it's beautiful. All right. We won't talk about Windsor. Windsor's even like, difficult, but Slough is very, very beautiful. And from there, I went on to become a GP. I'm what's known as a portfolio GP. So I do lots of different specialisms. One of them is that I'm a GP with a specialist interest in women's health. I've then later on become an author. I also run my own contraception clinics as well with my other NHS colleagues. And then now I do medical broadcasting. So mainly I work with the BBC and ITV. And since then, after the pandemic, I've become an educator. So I make a lot of health content creating and lots of accessible information in different languages for individuals, well, globally now, working with the World Health Organization and YouTube Health. So that's a little bit about me. What we're going to start by doing is I'm going to ask Dr. Ellen, because she has written her book, Why Can't I See My GP? And then roll that out to you and ask why it's that you're struggling to see your doctor. Now that we do have a new government, hopefully at some point they'll watch this recording where the sound isn't so echoey and we will have some stipulations for the government. So Ellen, let's get started. We both are GPs. Both of us were in surgery yesterday. But what are the barriers of the biggest issues that patients can't see their doctor? Because you shared in your book where you struggled yourself to get an appointment.
Yep, that's right. So I think the reason I wrote this book was because during the pandemic, I joined the Doctors Association UK, and we did a lot of work talking about what was going on in general practice. There was a huge media narrative at that time that GPs were lazy, we were sitting at home, we were doing absolutely nothing. And that couldn't have been further from the truth, I'm sure you'll agree. And that was incredibly frustrating. As a patient myself, I could see it was a struggle to see a GP, but we were working harder than ever. And that mismatch wasn't really being spoken about in the media. So this book was an accumulation of that work to try and get the message out there. There are many reasons you can't see a GP, but it's not because we're lazy. It's not because of this media message that we're doing nothing. And the reasons are complex. So I think, first of all, we've got less GPs than we did 10 years ago. We've got more patients, and GPs are burning out. They're leaving the profession, and the GPs that are left are really struggling to cope with the workload that that is left.
Let's focus on that a little bit, because you do start at the journey of general practice and the journey of the NHS, because to get the NHS was a lot of toil and struggle and pain, but then to get GPs on board. So why is it that general practice was never part of the original NHS structure?
Well, that's quite interesting. I think when it first started, it was the birthday of the NHS yesterday, it was very, very different from how it is today. And GPs were often working out of their front rooms. GPs were mainly male. Their wives were answering the telephones. And it was often just a one-man job with the wife doing all of the legwork. And then compared to today, it's got similar values and the structure hasn't really changed that much from the basics that was set up in 1948. But it's entirely different today. And medicine's changed, the world has changed, we've got the internet, we've got mobile phones, everything is different from 70 years ago. So yeah.
So let's fast forward a little bit, because GPs then had to come on board, as did dentists and opticians, because they were running their own private businesses and they were then given a contract which they were handed out based on the number of patients they were looking at and the complex diseases. And the government would then say, right, this is the amount of money that we're going to give you because this is the ballpark figure of what we think that you're going to need. What happened after the contracts were handed out? Because the GP practices were getting bigger and bigger. You couldn't run out of your front room anymore with your wife answering the telephone calls.
Well, the structure has changed over the years. And in the 70s, I think it was, that's when GPs started to band together and make practices and decide we can work together as a team to try and make things a bit more efficient. Just to pick up on one of the things you said about the contract with the government, I think there's a misunderstanding that NHS GPs are private doctors.
Yeah.
And it is complicated. I think it does take a lot of reading through what actually the contract is. But an NHS GP is different from a GP on Harley Street who is a private doctor, because NHS GPs have a contract with the government to provide an NHS service, whereas private doctors don't. So although they run the businesses, they provide an NHS service. And that's where a lot of the tides come in. And that's where we do depend on the government for funding and to be able to run the service properly. So we don't always have the autonomy that we would if it was our own business.
As GPs, both of us have been doctors now for about 18 years working in the NHS. We've definitely seen that the change has happened. The pandemic, so let's fast forward a little bit further. The pandemic came around and the way that we changed working dramatically did change overnight for us. So explain a bit further.
Well, as you very well know, and as many, I can see some GPs in the audience will know very well, we changed overnight from face-to-face consulting to remote, which we never really did that before. We did telephone consults, but we never did it to the extent we did after the pandemic. And it was overnight. We literally had to recreate the system so that patients could get seen safely. And we've got short memories. It does seem 4 years ago now, it does seem like a bit of a distant memory, but there was a fear at the time. It was an unknown virus. We didn't know what we were dealing with. And we did want to keep people safe. We didn't want to have people in waiting rooms coughing all over each other, spreading the virus. So we had to work remotely. And there was a government incentive at the time to do that. But then slowly, slowly, as time went on, the media message was that GPs are closed. Look at these empty waiting rooms. GPs are doing nothing. But we weren't. The statistics at the time showed that we were seeing more patients than ever before. We were just seeing them differently.
And I think that's the media messaging that was about, and that's where conspiracy theories came, that COVID wasn't real, the fact that actually it's a hoax. And that's when we tried to roll out the vaccine and we got the anti-vax message as well. And there were lots of mistakes that were made in regards to the PPE that was given to doctors as well, so that we weren't able to protect ourselves. The pandemic was a particularly personally difficult time for me. My middle son has had a liver transplant. He had liver cancer when he was about 2 years old and needed 6 rounds of chemo. And the only way to get him better was to give him a transplant. So he was on immunosuppressants. So I, as a doctor, was working without PPE with an unknown virus. I did get COVID and then stayed separately from my son at my parents' house, actually in their annex at the bottom of the garden, because I didn't know whether my son would get very, very sick. And because he'd already had a very complicated history, I've seen him on ITU and be intubated 3 separate times before. It was the most horrific experience. If anyone's got a loved one who's ever been intubated, I honestly don't be there when they do that, because it is not a comfortable experience. And so before even shielding was a thing, now everybody uses the word furlough as if they know what that means. None of us knew what that meant at the time. None of us knew what shielding meant at the time. And the difficulty that we had as GPs was, how do we protect our loved ones as well as ourselves, as well as our patients? So the only way to do that was to make sure that our doors were closed, metaphorically, but we were working from behind the scenes. So I set up home remote consulting with my patients, and I was constantly in touch with my patients locally. And unfortunately, the numbers that we were seeing of patients dying in our practices was increasing and increasing in the most vulnerable groups, when you knew that this was a virus and it's preventable, that with the right measures that we could have prevented a lot of the deaths. Our surgery looked after 3 nursing homes as well. And we've had lots of difficulties with our nursing home patients, because we would send them into hospital, the hospitals couldn't cope, and they were sent back. It was an incredibly, I would say, fundamentally the most horrific time, and that took its mental toll, and burnout has been huge and immense since then. And as a fraternity, I don't think we've had that national conversation of what happened in general practice. We've seen the TV program about breathtaking, what happened in hospitals, but I think general practice still, we haven't had that conversation, have we?
Well, general practice was seen as hiding away. You're not doing the work, you're not seeing people, but general practitioners were some of the first healthcare professionals to die from the virus. They didn't have the PPE that the hospitals had, and the hospital didn't always have great PPE, but there was reports of people using bin bags and going to B&Q and just making their own, and they weren't protected and they were working. And that's, I think, where doctors started to burn out, because they were working harder than ever, worrying about their families, worrying about dying, worrying about the patients, and being told by the media that they were lazy, good for nothings. And doctors did burn out. We have seen doctors killing themselves. We've had a lot of GP suicides over the last 5 years. And some of that media message does have a responsibility there, the message that was being given out.
So the shocking statistic is every 3 weeks a doctor commits suicide in the UK, and that doesn't make national headlines at the moment. And it's disgusting that that is what's happening, because it should, and it should be that conversation that we're having. In your book, you do cover one of our colleagues that sadly passed away. She was local to me and was my trainer. Could you share that story with our audience?
Well, it's her husband who shared the story, and he attributed her death by suicide directly to her job as a GP. She was working 70-hour weeks. She was going in on her days off. She had a laptop at home, which I'm very, very many GPs are familiar with, this phenomena of taking your laptop home and working all night to get on top of the admin, the results, the documents. She was working harder than ever. And she lost perspective. She was hearing the message in the media that we were doing nothing. She had patients coming, given verbal abuse, given physical abuse. I think the abuse had a lot to do with it as well. And she took herself off into the woods and killed herself. And her husband posted a very heartfelt social media post afterwards, and he said it was the job that killed her.
And I think that behind that, it's her husband and 2 boys, but also a whole practice that's left 1 GP down. And as a colleagues, there's been a real struggle in our local area, because again, it's a shock, but also when you think about it and you're looking at the workload that's building and building, you're looking at your other colleagues, and the taboo and the stigma when it comes to mental health disease is still something, again, we need to unpack in general practice as the pressure mounts, because our colleague was so busy dealing with the mental health of her patients that there's that sense of neglect that happens to us as clinicians, which we often get. So we do find that clinicians actually present later to their own GP to get a diagnosis, because, you know, the physician, heal thyself. You want to treat yourself because you sort of know the medicine. And actually, as doctors, we are the worst patients. So if you have a doctor that's on your books, try and avoid them. No, I'm joking. I'm not doing that. Let's move on a little bit further, because now we do have a new government. We're freshly out of an election, which at times was a very difficult listen, especially because the NHS was on the manifesto and the agenda. Interestingly for me, women's health, so 50% of the population are women, wasn't as one of the objectives of improving women's health on the agenda, but we will still continue to campaign. Out of the conversations that have been happening around general practice, because we've got the NHS framework that's changing in how NHS is going to be accessible So we've had promises of AI in our local surgery, in my surgery now. To book an appointment, you have to go through an app, fill out a questionnaire, and they'd signpost you to the right individual, and you might not actually get told that you need to see the GP. There's the introduction of physician's associates, there's emergency paramedics, there's allied healthcare professionals. So the previous government rolled out pharmacy first. So if you've got minor illnesses, you can go to your pharmacist. And that's been a hit and miss at different times. And also we've got dispensary staff. So GP practices who have clinical pharmacists or clinical nurse practitioners who are dealing with the patient even before you come to the GP. What are your thoughts on the changing framework?
Well, I think that the next government needs to make the NHS take it out of the political arena, basically, and make sure that they form a cross-party group with the NHS. So I think each party made lots of promises and had their manifesto promises, but they're asking NHS staff to deliver these promises with how. They don't really give a clear plan of how to achieve this. And what I do think is that if you form a cross-party group with all of the parties and they work together, and it's no longer, the NHS no longer depends on who's in power, that's something that they can use to stabilise the NHS so everyone can work together to create policies that are going to work and be longer lasting. You mentioned PAs and allied staff. I'm not sure if you're aware, but the government funded a pot of money for GP practices to employ PAs, non-doctors. So although we've got less doctors and we need more doctors, we've got this paradox at the minute where we've got GPs who are out of work and they can't get work because practices can't employ them. Because the money that they have for staff is only to employ these allied staff. And that's
the ARS funding. Yeah. So what happens is that the policies was made that actually what we'll have is a pot of money, the ARS funding. So that means that it's the allied funding pot. And the stipulation of that pot being given to GP practices, who are individual businesses, but under the umbrella of the NHS, is to say to them, but you cannot employ a doctor. So an MBBS or a GP as a locum doctor. And that really came from the problem that was general practice was having, was that locum GPs were increasing because they wanted a work-life balance or burnout, or they were portfolio doctors, but the rates of GPs was increasing as well. So there wasn't a cap on how much a GP could ask. So across the country, depending on a geographic model, depending on what the demand was, some GPs were charging, say, £160 an hour, to some GP locums only charging £40 or £50 an hour. And because there was no regulation on that, they tried to. So we've had sort of this feast and famine stage in general practice where there was this a lot of money that was given to locum doctors, but then that meant that patients didn't have a named doctor. Now, I'm very passionate about having a named doctor. I think you should, because you have continuity of care. But the way the structure is set up is that it's very difficult to have a named doctor, because when somebody is away on sick leave, or you've got other commitments, or that you have, you know, work-life balance because of burnout, you cannot work that you are the person that sees your patient all the time. So that's why they started to introduce allied healthcare professionals who could do minor illnesses. On balance with that, as GPs, as we were saying, is that when it comes to doctors, it's about the undifferentiated cases. So I saw 35 patients yesterday in my morning clinic from different conditions, different diseases. Not all were women's health at all. But if I saw 35, let's sort of say, if I saw 35 patients, and it's working out which one of those patients needs a hospital admission, which one of those patients needs a cancer referral, which one that could wait for a couple of days and actually it's a social issue and I need my social care team to get involved, which one of those might be a safeguarding issue. And it's that sort of undifferentiated cases that we see which makes general practice ever so problematic. And I often say to my colleagues, imagine you're driving a car and every single patient that you see, you only have 10 to 15 minutes and it's a constant gear shift. You're shifting sort of how much risk am I carrying with each individual patient. And that is what you're doing for 3 to 4 hours in one morning slot. And then at the end of it, you're exhausted. Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's the problem. Getting these allied staff, I think they're great in some roles, but what they're being used for is to see these undifferentiated patients, and they don't have even half the training of a GP, but they're expected to see patients in the same way as a GP, and it is causing problems. And it hasn't reduced the workload, because it means GPs still have to supervise these professionals. And I think for patients, it's not good because you end up having multiple appointments to get your problem solved. So you see one, maybe PA, then you see a nurse, and you go round in circles on a merry-go-round until you actually get the care that you need. So it's a false economy, really.
So a multi-dollar question then on the false economy. Does the NHS need more money then?
Yes.
That's a good question.
It's a simple answer.
Does it need more staff?
Yes.
It does, doesn't it? I would say, actually, I think we can work smarter. I don't think we need money. And
we do need money.
We do, but actually, I'll give you a couple of examples where we have been working and making some strides. So working towards a hopeful NHS. A lot of people might not be aware, but in the last 3 to 4 years, we have been working an all-parliamentary women's health strategy. That's a 10-year strategy run by Dame Leslie Regan. And we have made women's health not a political issue in this country. And that's because the statistics and the data show from Hologic that actually we rank as the 20th worst country in the world in regards to delivering women's health. And as a first world country with free NHS, the fact that we rank so badly in regards to maternity care, menopause care, and beyond. And diagnosis for endometriosis takes 10 years. And we actually still don't understand the causes of, say, uterine fibroids or endometriosis or adenomyosis. And women's pain gets nullified. So after a lot of background campaigning, the women's health strategy for England became a non-political issue. And that's what was interesting, because you said if we take the NHS and not make it a political issue, and all parliamentary groups, and we've done that with women's health. So Lib Dems, Labour, and also the Tories are all involved in the women's health strategy. And what's interesting out of this is that we are now thinking of all of us as groups, thinking of how can we utilise what we already have. So there's the introduction of women's health hubs, but also how can we utilise groundwork that's already been doing? Because the biggest issue we have when it comes to women's health is trust. Actually, the whole of healthcare is trust. So cost-saving stuff that we have already done is by engaging with marginalized communities, whether it's LGBTQ+, Black and Asian, traveler communities, they all have different needs. So it's not about delivering equality of care anymore. It's about delivering equity. So Black communities have completely different needs to, say, a traveler community when it comes to women's health, because their belief around pregnancy care or menopause care is completely different. And we've started something called the Health Collective, where we've mapped in England all the grassroots communities that are already doing that work with the support of NHS England and the Department of Health. And that means that actually marginalised communities are telling us what they need. So they are doing the work. We are then attributing that pot of money because it's fundamentally what they need, because women in Chelsea have completely different needs to women in Tower Hamlets. So I'll give you an example where this has worked quite well. Breast screening is really difficult, and getting women to go for their mammograms is difficult depending on which marginalized communities you talk to. So we worked with a Somalian community in Tower Hamlets. They have their own set of language. They understand how to get the men on board. And we worked with Imperial University, and we got the groups to come to speak to us. I'm working on this with Dame Leslie Regan. And they said the women from the Somalian community don't come from their mammograms. And we worked out by one of the grassroots organizations said to me, but you need to get the men to come to all of these meetings about self-checking for breasts. But if you put a picture of a breast or you have a mannequin of a breast, the men won't come because they'll think it's a women's issue. But if you make bread, dough balls with us, we'll put a frozen pea in there. So what did we do? We ran a workshop. We got the Somalian men in. We made bread dough balls with them because that's culturally acceptable, put a frozen pea in it, and said to them, this is what your wife needs to look for with all the women in the community. Now, that's culturally nuanced education. And the men all left going, I will make sure that my wife goes. And we've seen the uptake of breast screening go up. Small interventions made equitable means that actually you don't need a lot of funding. And that's where we think that we can actually roll that out within the NHS, because the allied health individuals and grassroots organizations and people who are already doing the work understand and have built that trust. And we saw that happen in the pandemic. We engage with mosques, synagogues, temples, gurdwaras, communities in their own languages, because not all communities will engage well with, say, the English language. They do it through song or dance. And so I think the future for me would be that it has to be that you look at engaging the whole population with that trust building exercise. That's just a small example, I'm cherry picking, but I do feel that there's hope in the future.
But that happened in the pandemic as well. And I think what you say is true. General practice in London is different from where I am up in Cumbria. And in the pandemic, again, demonstrated what GPs can do. So they wasted all that money on the track and trace.
Yeah.
But GPs were given the vaccines and they delivered them. And if you just give GPs enough money and funding and resources to deliver to their local communities, then they will, because they know their communities. And the policy that's made in Westminster, you cannot make a policy for the whole country. It has to be local and it has to be targeted to communities, like you say.
Absolutely. It has to be collaboration. We go further and faster and longer if we collaborate and don't care who takes the credit, because the delivery of the vaccine, the GPs and community care and volunteers, GPs come out of retirement, colleagues have came out, everybody from sort of, you know, who could volunteer, did volunteer. And that's why we are able to sit in places like this. Now we want to hand over the mic to you guys. You've heard a lot of us doctors just gossiping. Now is your opportunity to ask those questions. And we'll hand out the mic to you.
Don't smoke, take regular exercise, keep an eye on your weight and eat plenty of fruit and veg. Advice given to me over 40 years ago by a practice nurse. And I thought about it and I thought, did most of them, except regular exercise, I walked to the car. From that moment on, I started to do regular exercise. I owe that woman a lot. I don't even know her, you know, her name or whatever. It's a simple message and it's about prevention before, I know some things can come out of the blue, but there's an awful lot you're dealing with that would be around that preventive measure. And I, as I say, it changed my life. And I, in fact, COVID, what can I do when it lifted a bit? I can go to the gym more often, can't I? You know, and that's, it was those sorts of things, possibly having both parents with strokes also affected the way I look. Health, it's your first wealth.
Absolutely. And let me just talk about general practices were set up actually with the theme of not emergency care, because we've got A&E to do that, but it was that preventative piece.
One of the things that I recommend in my book, thinking about solutions, because it's not all doom and gloom, is putting the NHS on the school curriculum. And I know teachers will sigh and say we've got enough to teach, but simple things like self-care, how to deal with coughs and colds, things that you don't need to see the GP for, or where you can go, other places such as the pharmacy, and as you say, lifestyle and how to be healthy.
My GP friends tell me that general practice is facing a triple crisis. One is the workforce issue that you mentioned. It was a model that was designed for men, and I'm quoting a female GP friend here, men who had wives at home, who brought the children up, looked after the house, fed the man on those rare occasions when he got home before midnight. And people coming into general practice now are predominantly female. Predominantly, they go part-time in their 30s, and I'm afraid drop out in their 40s. Partly burnout, as you say. Second challenge is increasing morbidity in the population, which means the number of patient consultations per head is rising and lists are rising. And the third one is competition from private sector online providers who cream off the wealthier, healthier working population. And so that says to me the model is bust. The 1948 model hasn't got a long-term future. I have a friend who is a professor of public health, and he was commissioned to a commission some time ago to look at GP models in Europe. And they were very surprised to find that only two countries had a system like ours, and that was Britain and the Netherlands. So I wonder if there's a big picture piece around where the model goes, whether the model is sustainable. And there's a second part of it, which is that as the NHS funding grows, and it has grown consistently for 40, 50 years, almost everything goes to hospitals. The general practice, I think, its share of the cake is actually still shrinking. So whatever model we have, how do we push back against the hospitals gobbling everything up? Thank you.
I think you make some really brilliant points, but a couple of things that I think that we need to do is that general practice, I always believe, fundamentally will survive because the patients will want it to survive.
And so we know that cost saving in regards to hospital admissions happens because the GPs are, as I hate using this word because we're not really gatekeepers, but it's that undifferentiated case of knowing who's sick enough to go into hospital, because resources in hospitals, the MRI machines, the blood tests, they're all really expensive. Yesterday, I probably only did one blood test out of the 35 patients that I saw that I thought that needed it, because my clinical acumen, I believe, is that good now that actually I don't need it. And then the next thing is that the access to information has to change. Save some trees, let's not do printouts. And the way that it works at the moment, and this is why I'm working with the World Health Organization and YouTube Health, is that people do use social media for their information, whether that's unvetted, which it is at the moment. It's a bit like the Wild West. You know, you could have something and die tomorrow, or actually the only thing you should be having is this excessive sort of supplement and, you know, the treatment for cancer is there. It is a Wild West, and there's so much misinformation that we battle with on social media. But we need to get out of our clinical rooms as doctors and go on social media, because what our patients are consuming is then making their way into our consulting rooms. The way that the healthcare has to change in the infrastructure ways is that we have to follow, if we think it like a consumer, because it is a business, there is money coming in. Yes, there's no profit, but you have to chase what the consumer is doing. We are now in a twilight zone where people are so used to Amazon service. You order something today and it comes tomorrow. Healthcare doesn't work like that, but people do think it does. I get lots of patients who come in who were, but my blood pressure should have been dealt with yesterday. Why do I have to wait 3 weeks to go and see a cardiologist now? Or why do I have to wait this long? And I think that's where we've got to be savvier as a way, and possibly, and dare I say it, as someone who does do social media content, is that be brave enough to tackle the new frontier of AI, because that is going to play a huge impact on how we deliver public health messaging and how people do the preventative bit and look after themselves.
Yeah, and I would agree. I'd just like to touch on the part-time comment, because at the minute, most GPs are classed as part-time, but I think we do ourselves a disservice. So I work 6 sessions, which is 3 days, but actually in those 3 days, often the hours that are done, the average number of hours that you do in a working week. So we are classed as part-time, but the hours we're doing are not part-time. And we need to rebrand ourselves, I think, because if you actually did 5 days a week as a GP, you'd be working, people don't do it because it's too many hours to work clinically, because the work overspills and you end up doing far more than doctors used to.
That's made me think about it, because, you know, I work full-time, I would say, because I do 6 sessions. So I do 3 days in clinical care, and then I do 2 days in media. And if I look at my book, so my book is all, firstly, full of diversity and colour. When I was at medical school, I never had pictures like this. Yes, I know, shocking on a Saturday morning. But so imagine my father's face when he saw it. And I should just add, my father is an imam, so he was even more shocked. But having pictures and colours and diversity and, you know, being represented is where we really do need to diversify a lot more. So it's equity. It's about giving the communities at their level or what they need, and everybody needs it differently. We're beyond now just giving everybody the same. And so the changing of how we teach doctors to become doctors has to change. So skin conditions on black and Asian skin, you know, somebody like me who walks in feels really let down every single time because they've never seen what eczema looks like on brown skin, or the assumption that I wear a hijab, so I must have had FGM at some point. So all of that sort of assumption medicine that we do, and there is institutionalized racism as well. So we've got to really tackle that, because actually it's just the other barriers of people then engaging with the NHS and thinking that this is where I'm going to get advice, and then going elsewhere for their information. And that comes from us as doctors. So I spend a lot of time for that representation piece and the knowledge that I've acquired looking after marginalized groups to teach my colleagues. We have a saying in medicine, you know, see one, do one, teach one. A lot of GPs will know that. And essentially, the only way that we can access information and teach our colleagues is what I come across. So I was talking to Dr. Ellen today about cervical screening, and how, as a Muslim woman, I went in Ramadan, and there's some groups of thoughts that say you should never have a cervical screening, which is a life-saving, you know, procedure. You can pick up very early signs of HPV and very early signs of sort of changes within cells with cervical cancer. who completely don't go in Ramadan, but we have no clinical pathways to support women to say that it's okay, and scholars need to get involved. So this is where that sort of nuanced piece, I think, is where we're going to be heading in the future.
Good morning. So my daughter's a year four medical student, and I just wanted to share with you some of the sort of experiences she's had as kind of a doctor in waiting. So year one, she got asked to defer a year because there weren't enough doctors to train her. She didn't take it, thank God. And now she's on clinical placement. The GPs that she's going to see are having an absolute nightmare because they're given so many students and they're struggling. So she's not getting a great experience either. And she really wanted to do GP. She said, there's no way, Mum, they're absolutely knackered. And even on hospital placement, she's getting turned away because the doctors are saying, oh, I've got 12 clinics this morning. I can't see you. I can't train you. And she's year four. So I don't know what the government are going to do about training these new doctors, because they're there, they're waiting, but they're relying on a broken service to train the upcoming doctors.
And we've had similar stories of fully qualified GPs who are now Uber drivers, especially in the area, again, because they cannot find work because the funding isn't there to pay their salary at all. And that's the situation that we've got to. I suppose this quick answer before I head over to Ellen is, I really hope the new government tackle that funnel neck that we've got at the moment, because that's what it is. It's a bottleneck. We've got all the prime doctors who are qualified, who are desperate and passionate like your daughter. We just don't have the individuals to train them. And then a lot of the junior doctors that are coming through are saying, well, I can't even walk into a job like I used to because I'm having allied healthcare professionals who are actually backed by funding in that particular area that I want to go to, like general practice, so what's the point? And then planning to go abroad.
Yeah, I think there's always been an element of teaching on the job, and that's how you learn, is it? You watch, see one, do one, teach one. But yeah, I can't imagine what it's like for medical students now, because where is the time to fit it all in? And these medical students are now graduating with hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of debt, and they're coming into a bit of a broken system. And that's where the government does need to invest in the staff. And when we qualified, we had free accommodation. Colleagues have gone to move abroad to New Zealand, where they get free food, they get free training, all the courses we have to do to stay working as GPs, that's covered. And investing in the staff, I think, is probably one of the biggest things that this new government could do. So hopefully they will.
My question is around the A&Es and the GP. So we've got the A&E and then we've got the GP. Could there be something which is before that? Could the pharmacies take on something more, or could that model be looked at to see how we can take the pressures off the GP and the hospitals? Because putting more money in and remodeling it, there's always going to be that less money which is going to be there. What ways could we look at to tackle something like that? You know, some might have a cough, might not need to see a GP. Yes, we could go to a pharmacy and say, okay, there's this medication available. Is there something in between a GP to going to an hospital? Is there something right at the beginning which could be done, which could then alleviate the pressures on the GP and the hospital?
Well, they started to trial pharmacy first. Our good old friend Rishi Sunak did that by hiring contracts with pharmacies and saying that you can deliver, say, coughs and colds or ear infections, or the fact that you might have a routine or an uncomplicated urine infection that doesn't need to go to the doctor. The problem is that undifferentiated cases, because pharmacies already have so much in regard to the medication. So if you look at the fact that we've got an elderly population and now we've got complicated diseases as well, some patients could be on 8 or more different types of medications now. And that is the average that we're seeing. So pharmacies are already having their own burnout issues and retention and recruitment because of difficulties in abuse and workload. Then we did trial, I don't know whether you remember, the Darzi centres. So Lord Darzi came in and we had walk-in centres so that you could, it was an interim between general practice and also A&E. The problem was retention again and getting the bodies in those spaces. So it's not about getting a building or a newfangled thing. It's about getting people to do that work, to have that educational piece. And that's what we tried to do with the Women's Health Strategy, is that actually, if you educate, so if you just look at women's health, if you educate women for the signs of symptoms of breast cancer, the signs and symptoms of, say, endometriosis, or managing pain over the counter, then actually a majority of them can be managed in community medicine without needing to go to A&E or without needing to go to a GP. if we start to, and we've started looking at an educational program, a national education program for menopause. So we've done it in different spaces. So if you look at the NCT model, so that means that pregnant women and their partners go and see a midwife and they get education of this is what birth is like, this is what the birth plan is like, this is what the pregnancy is going to be like. If we do similar educational things with women around menopause, actually the majority of them might not actually go to the GP because they're going to do that piece unless they want to have medication such as HRT. And then they'll go and see someone like me who's trained to deliver menopause care on the NHS and provide HRT. So it's about that work of funneling the individual in the right pathway, because that actually requires less, because we've tried different models and they've also all fallen apart. The biggest thing is how do we get the patient to see the right individual at the right time, but where can the patient take responsibility and have that prevention piece that they should be doing as well? And that comes back to education. Schools are already, we're battling with, because they're not happy about teaching. They've got their own pressures. So that's where grassroots engage. So we're looking at that workload at the moment. And then I think this is why we've got to start engaging with social media like TikTok, YouTube, because if you look at this election as an educational tool, it's fascinating because the data is coming out that social media and TikTok played a huge role in who you voted. I mean, that's why the Lib Dems did their whole sort of, if you look at their strategy, actually, as someone who's on social media as an educational tool, the engagement that they got with the younger voters resonated because he was doing innovative marketing. So he was baking with children or say skydiving with a really important message underneath that. And I think that's how people are going to start to having to learn preventative healthcare. So that's the future.
Yeah, I'd agree. So Pharmacy First has caused a lot more work for GPs, I think. And a cough isn't always just a simple cough. A UTI isn't always just a simple UTI. It could be so many other things. And it isn't the training there to see these undifferentiated patients and things get missed, or they just end up coming back to the GP, when in fact the pot of money given for Pharmacy First could have just been given to general practice to deal with the problems there. I think the easy problems we can just see quite quickly, and it's a quite quick presentation, and it stops this churn and the merry-go-round of seeing multiple people again and again.
Is there like a system where they pick who they're going to see? Because for example, I went to my GP and I said, oh, I just need a dipstick test, and I had to have an appointment and I was seen in 20 minutes. And then when I'd gone a few weeks before and said, I think my son's developing an eating disorder, I need him to get that care now, it's 6 weeks before we can see you. And I'm just thinking, that's not acceptable for 6 weeks for potential eating disorders. But then it's like, how come I can be seen in 20 minutes and yet my son is being told 6 weeks before we'll even see you to then look at getting you in the right path? Luckily he had another support team, so he did get some support before. But do you kind of prioritize certain cases, thinking this needs to be seen, that can wait, and is that fair to everybody?
So I think it works differently in different practices, and every practice will have a slightly different system. In our practice, we work on a system now where everyone gets triaged, so it's almost a same day service, and everyone calls in. It's converted it basically into e-consults, and there's a doctor who triages all the calls, and a lot of things can be dealt with same day. Something might need a bit more of a investigations first, or something might need A&E, something might need pharmacy. But yeah, the system isn't perfect. We're working with what the staff we have, the demand we have, and that doesn't sound like great care, and it isn't perfect.
Oh, hi. So the talks, why can't I see my GP? What I've noticed, as I'm sure everyone has, there's so many different ways now, different GP practices are different about how you might get an appointment. But there is so many blocks to just getting through the door. So, for example, you mentioned some form that has to be filled in. I had a nightmare trying to assist somebody with that who didn't have English as their first language. It took me hours on the phone with him asking all sorts of personal questions, and then he'd aborted it at the end. And I mean, in that example, that man only managed to get an appointment, even despite my numerous calls to the surgery, by walking into the surgery one day and collapsing on the floor. And I know that's an extreme example, but someone in my own family is quite challenged by any technology. And the other thing is, a lot of the surgeries seem to say, you've got to phone at 8 o'clock. You phone and then they say, is it urgent? Is it important? And I've had this situation again with somebody close to me So they kept saying, oh, I can't say that. It could wait a few days. So they say no, and they don't get an appointment. They don't even get an appointment in a few days until, you know, it's come to a crisis. And finally, I said, you've got to say it's urgent. And they were seen, and now they're being whirled through loads of tests. But I am worried about how to get an appointment. It's really a problem for a lot of people. It doesn't matter whether you're articulate or, but obviously it's even worse if you can't do technology, you don't have English as your first language. It's really, really a problem in this area. Is there some more imaginative way of working out how, because you've got too many people and not enough appointments, I get that, but is there any better way of working out how to do this? And this triage system is a bit worrying on the phone because you don't see the person. So the person I'm talking about, another person, if they'd seen them, they'd have gone, my God, you look ill.
Well, yeah, I had a patient yesterday who walked through the door and he was fine. His sister had made him the appointment and he was deathly pale and immediately he didn't look right. But I wouldn't have picked that up on the phone, and I took his bloods and he had an HB of 7, which is very low, and he needed a blood transfusion. But you're right, I wouldn't have picked that up on the phone and he would have said, I'm fine. My sister made the appointment. There's nothing wrong with me. But there was something wrong with him. But yeah, I think if we had the answer for that, we would solve general practice, wouldn't we? But as I say in my book, I had the same problem. I was on the phone to my own surgery, calling 19 times, I think it was. And as a doctor, you think I'd be able to get through. But we're working with the systems we've got, and it is difficult, and there isn't an easy answer. In the past, I worked in a surgery where the patients could show up and just get seen. But that was a surgery on the shores of Lake Ullswater with a list of 800 patients, and you could do that. But with a list size of 30,000 patients, you cannot do that. And I think the e-consult system has its problems with technology, but at least it means that people can tell the GP their problem. They avoid a queue where nobody speaks to them and nobody answers them, and they're on a list where the doctor can at least triage and help them. But I agree, it's not perfect, and I don't really know what the solution is other than trying to get more staff on the phones, triaging, have more doctors available to see the patients who need to be seen.
So I actively hate the e-consult, I'll be honest, as a mother with a chronically sick child as well. So you can imagine how difficult it is to get an appointment for him. But, you know, as GPs, we do access our own general practice surgery for support. And you're absolutely, you make a really good point about not just English being a first language, but digital poverty. We just assume everybody has WhatsApp and everybody has phones, and they're not the cost of living crisis. Not everybody does have that. And we do have access to, say, Wi-Fi, depending on what I live at. Sometimes the villages that I work in, the Wi-Fi connection is awful and you can't speak to them. And then finally, when these cost-cutting measures are taken out, the human-to-human interaction goes, and you're just talking to machines. And all of us have known how terrible that is. And actually, that leads to, weirdly, rightly so, more workload. I can't stand or bear Teams meetings or Zoom calls anymore. I'd rather travel and see that person face-to-face. And that's actually when things get done. You sit on a Zoom call, and nothing actually productive happens at the end of it until you see that person in face-to-face, you pin them down, and lo and behold, what you actually wanted out of that meeting to come does happen. And I suppose that the problem is finding that balance about other issues as well. So if you're talking about traveling all the time, impact on the environment, people coming up physically to the surgery, spreading infections in a surgery, and we're not there yet to find out the right balance with that. We've got to, as GPs, we're constantly thinking of how can we keep our patients safe. And that is the fundamental problem that we've got. Hopefully West Streeting can sort it. I don't know.
When I worked on cruise ships, it was a system where you paid to see the doctor, and that's one of the solutions people say, put a charge on the GP appointment, make people pay. But it didn't work. It was the same patients waiting to see the same doctor, and they still had to wait the same amount of time. They just had to pay $100 to do so. And if there's a perfect system out there, I think that would solve a lot of problems, but there isn't, and I think we have to work with what we've got and try and be as safe as possible.
By charging for a GP appointment, we will fundamentally have the destruction of primary care, because again, it's the most vulnerable, the most affected by cost of living, the ones that are the, you know, domestic violence. Because my group of patients, we do have pockets of poverty, huge pockets, but then we have lots of sort of patients who in Buckinghamshire who are very well off as well. But then you miss those individuals. So if they don't make an appointment actually sometimes a lot of these issues are not based on your education, your need or your want, or that you don't have means. Domestic abuse, for example, regardless of your standing or where you are, I see it in every class, creed, background, race, religion, ethnicity. And if you start charging appointments and those women don't come to the practice, but they'll be hidden even further. And that would devastate, I think, what I would do. And it would make me leave becoming a doctor if we charged appointments. I mean, I'm hanging on by my fingernails as it is in the NHS or various other bureaucratic things. But I think for charging people would be the last bit that I would say, no, that's not for me.
It's been a really interesting talk. Thank you very much for your time. I'm a GP partner in Bradford, and I also have a private clinic. And going back to your question about why I can't see my GP, I think it's because there aren't enough GPs. There's a few reasons for that. Recruitment is a huge issue. As a partner, you know, we've struggled as a practice to get GPs to come and actually work for us. The workload is absolutely horrendous. That's why people don't want to work full time. I couldn't work full time as a GP. It would affect my mental and emotional well-being, although I consider myself to be a very resilient person. I don't think it's something I could do. And I also think that the media and the government, successive governments, have made GPs out to be not at the same level as consultants. And, you know, we are really specialists in our own field. We are really the only true generalists left in medicine, apart from A&E doctors. And you've talked about undifferentiated disease. There's no other specialty that can deal with the multitude of problems that we deal with, the different hats we have to wear every 5 or 10 minutes. So I think the biggest issue is the lack of generalist practitioners to be able to deal with the complexity of problems that we have.
I absolutely agree, because if you look at it, there's so many conditions which don't fall under any speciality. So I'll take menopause. The reason menopause is in general practice, and that's why I'm fighting for it to be there, is because it's not an endocrinological condition, because it's not. So endocrinologists, the hormone doctors, won't look after it. It's not truly a gynecological condition, because it's a natural transition in life. So gynecologists don't get trained in menopause or don't think about HRT, because they're like, well, we've got surgeries or we've got actual diseases to look after. And so it falls back into general practice. Other conditions like Ehlers-Danlos. Ehlers-Danlos is not really it's an autoimmune condition, but where do you put it? Do you put it with the rheumatologist? Well, they're not going to look after it. Do you put it with the blood doctors, the hematologist? Well, they don't really want it because it doesn't fall under their remit. So it comes back into general practice. POTS disease, connective tissue disorders. I could go on with so many. So because we like to put people into boxes, but we're all circles who are made to fit into boxes. And that's where general practice is meant to be. You know, that's why my bread and butter is I'm a generalist, well, all and foremost. That cradle to grave scenario is absolutely true. And that's why I love being a GP. But then what the problem we have is that specialized minutiae area of expertise is where the consultants step in, but we're never good enough. And I think we've got to get over our own imposter syndrome to a degree as GPs, because that's us as a fraternity not supporting our own. And I know that's controversial, but that is true, because as GPs, we do sort of sometimes probably cower to secondary care medicine. Hence why when it comes to funding POTS and bidding for funding, hospital consultants have really good lobbyists and people who are able to support them, whereas general physicians, our imposter syndrome and self-doubt gets in the way. So we've got to step up now, really. That's controversial. Some people don't believe that. But
historically, I think GPs were the poor brother of hospital consultants, and there wasn't the complexity in 1948 that we've got today. So GPs maybe didn't do as much as do now. But also in other countries, people qualify as a GP straight out of medical school, and they don't have to do the training that we do here. So they are seen as not as qualified as the people who've specialised for 10 years. But in the UK, we do. We specialise. And I agree, we need to shout about what we do, because we do a lot. And we, as you said before, some of that money from secondary care should be coming to primary care, because we're super efficient and we do a lot with what we've got. And if we had more, we could do so much more.
I'm sure everyone else is curious like me. You ring at 8 o'clock and they're already engaged. You go up to the surgery, receptionist might be doing nothing. I've seen that with my own eyes several times. They're doing nothing and it's about 8, 5 past 8. When you're at home, the line's engaged. What is the system?
I can answer that. So the women that sit at the front of the desk, because of patient confidentiality, they're only meant to see people at the front of the desk. When we're asking questions, that's usually in the back room. In our surgery, it's upstairs, where we have four or five individuals who are in a private room, each to themselves, because you don't want the world listening to your conversation on the phone and what you're advising them to do. So we actually have a completely different, and that came about because patients sitting in the waiting room could overhear the receptionist conversation, and that's not great. And likewise, you know, doctors will have their own individual room. And when we make telephone consultations, there might be no patients in the waiting room, but I've got 35 patients who all need telephone calls or video calls that day. We have much of a commuter family area. So I've got people commuting into London who just want that quick phone call on the phone or a discussion via Zoom, or they want to actually just show me a quick photo of that rash that they've got. So that's fundamentally why. The other thing is that in our area, and I don't know what it's like in Bradford, but there's only certain lines that BT will give to GP surgeries because they have to charge extra. So it could be that your GP hotspot or that phone line, you've only got funding from your CCB now, Clinical Care Board, to have two lines. When you actually need, because the patient population is growing, the demand is growing, you've got more of a vulnerable population or an elderly population who have 16 problems that they want to discuss, not just that one problem, that you actually probably need 8 or 9 lines. And then the GP practice has to man those phones. There's no point having 8 lines, but you can't for love nor money hire a receptionist because the receptionists deal with the worst abuse anybody does. There's been many times when I've had to step outside of my consultation, stop, and then go to reception and tell that individual who rightly is very, very angry, very upset, like yourself, going in and going, the surgery's empty and you're just sitting there at the desk shouting abuse at my patient, at my receptionist. And I have to say, I will not see you or speak to you unless you go away and calm yourself down and apologize to my staff. 10 out of 10 times, the patient is absolutely understanding, and they will, because they are so frightened about the illness that they're dealing with. And I think that's the model that's changed. Gone are the days where you could just phone your GP and his wife and they'll be at the community centre, etc. And that's also changed as well. So I don't work in the area that I live in. And that's purely because for safety of us as GPs and also to keep patient confidentiality. My patients don't want to bump into me in the middle of Sainsbury's. Actually, they don't mind it now. I'll tell you a really quick story because a lot of my patients now see me on TV. I get a lot of them that come in and say to me, you're much nicer on the TV than you are in real life. So swings and roundabouts.
Unfortunately, I've had more contact with the NHS over the last 12 months than I'd want, but it's given me a little bit of an insight. And I think the worst words you want to hear are, you'll need to get a GP appointment more than anything else. I suppose we've got a new government. The NHS has been absolutely at the centre of what people have wanted to see change in. If you had the ear tomorrow of the health minister, Wes Streeting, like him or not, whatever, he is our health minister, what would be the most important thing that you would be asking for in order so this question can be answered?
Well, I'll start with that. For me, it's the staff. Invest in the staff. They are the biggest resource the NHS have. We need to invest in them. And it is money. People don't like talking about it, but I think it is money. We've been underfunded, disinvested. What general practice gets, it hasn't risen with inflation. So we just don't have enough money to run practices the way they should be. So money and staff is the one for me.
So I have a different relationship with Wes Streeting because we've been working with him all parliamentary women's health strategy. And this isn't hidden, it's very public, but he's suffered cancer himself. He's got over it and he had a lot of engagement with the NHS because he had all of his treatment on the NHS. So in a juxtaposition way, he's very much invested because he's gone through that pathway. We're meeting with him soon in regards to discussing further how we can actually then now start pick up work for the women's health strategy because we're focusing on the maternal health piece. Fundamentally, we need to stop the GP, the doctor strikes, the junior doctors. That's for me is the number one thing because everybody talks about junior doctors. These aren't junior doctors. They're senior doctors who've been there for, they just haven't made that consultant grade yet. And general practice, we have 8 junior doctors. They're not junior doctors, but they are training to become GPs. So whenever we get strikes, we lose them because they're out striking. And that means senior doctors like myself then pick up the workload, but I can only do what I can do in the time capacity. So we've got to stop these strikes. We've got to stop the nursing strikes as well. They are so fundamental into regards to the work that we do. And then we've got to look at retention. How do we make it a good profession where actually your heart doesn't sink when someone says, go and see the doctor or go and see the GP? Because I'm exactly the same. When someone says to me with my son, right, we're going to now refer you back to the GP, my heart sinks because I know I can't get that appointment. So either I can't jump the queue, even I am a doctor, but he's my son, so I'm removed from that. And then I think finally what we've got to do is that we've got to start emboldening the allied healthcare professional. I have nothing against all my allied healthcare professionals. I work with them. But what do I mean by that? What we need to be able to do is that build the confidence within patients to say, the GP is at the top of the tree, but they're not the people you need to see all the time. So be confident that if you're seeing the pharmacist, the nurse practitioner, the emergency worker at the surgery, if you're seeing the PAs with the good support that they get, they are just as valuable in providing you the support that you need. And that's the mindset that we've got. About 10 years ago, I wanted to do a contraceptive workshop. And I reached out to the marginalized communities in my group. And I said to them, I really want to do this contraception workshop because it'll allow women to plan their children, etc. And the woman that was running it, Saida was her name. She's Pakistani. And she goes to me, it's nice to have doctors come out their ivory towers to come out into the community. And that was my first fundamental way of understanding, actually, people think of us in community medicine at the top of the tree. And that if I see the doctor, then I will get the best care that I ever need, when actually the community are doing all of the work already. And I get that a lot. They're going to the pharmacist, and this is where Ellen was saying that workload is increased for us. And then the patient will come and see me 3 days later going, I just wanted to check that the pharmacist gave me the right advice. And I'm like, they did. Betty, they definitely gave you the right advice. And I think that's where we've got to now build the confidence. And so you guys here are going to be that magical jigsaw piece in building the confidence out in your communities to say, actually, do you know what? Seeing the doctor isn't always the best person. Your rash or your ear problem could be dealt with by the pharmacist. And that's where I think we need to also invest in.
I had a question around how GP surgeries and hospitals are sort of supposed to communicate. And I'll give you some context. So my mother, unfortunately, is sort of particularly susceptible to UTIs. And last year, she has diabetes as well. Last year, I think she was in and out of hospital sort of 3 or 4 times. And each time, you know, there'd be some notes that I think the hospital would send to the GP surgery saying, you know, please follow up on this, please investigate on this, you know, and then things wouldn't happen. Something, you know, it would recur, she would go back into the hospital. And so me and my older brothers, we kind of decided to sort of club together and get to see a private doctor, who then kind of identified the issue, put her on this sort of UTI vaccine, and think all in all, it could really cost us maybe about £2,000, and including the follow-up. Now, what I was then thinking afterwards is surely that number of hospital visits must have cost the system way more than £2,000. And I was wondering kind of how that sort of communication was supposed to work. My second question is unrelated to that. So my son recently cracked a tooth. We called the dentist. And he said, oh, we've got no appointments today. And I said, no, I'll pay privately. They said, come in in half an hour, they said. And it was the same practice, same receptionist. So I was kind of wondering what was going on there.
So one of the things that you raised really well is about UTIs. And the interplay with UTIs for women particularly is the impact of, say, hormones like estrogen, our anatomy, so the urethra being very close to the anal tissue as well. And then finally, the impact on our kidneys and our whole well-being as well. And if you look at it, that we have noticed that women are more prone to UTIs, yet the research and the data isn't done. So again, it doesn't really fall under any particular speciality. So that's why you get multiple hospital appointments and women's health doctors like me step in and we think about vaginal atrophy or genital urinary syndrome or the menopause. So we need to start thinking about that educational piece around doctors of how the estrogen hormone has a huge interplay with UTIs. Then it's the communication between hospitals, because we all have annoyingly different computer systems. Hospitals have a completely different computer system of writing down notes and how they communicate in the hospital to GP practice. So we use EMIS. Do you have System 1? No, EMIS. So general practice is EMIS, but there's System 1. There's four other different types which don't come to mind. And that means that, and then social care have their own computer system, but none of them join together and talk to each other. So I won't know what's happened at the hospital unless the patient comes with physical notes. Now, the plan is to change that, is to unify that. So we've got, in the last 10 years, we've had something called a smart card as doctors. So we're building that database up. Again, confidentiality, GDPR, making sure that other private companies don't get access to your information because then can make money out of patients. There's a lot of stuff that we need to be really careful about that. I always say you don't want Elon Musk all over your socials. And so what we need to do is allow patients to have access to that as well. Where we've seen it work really well, for all of those that will know who have had babies, is the purple hospital notes. So when they decided to look at getting effective maternity care to reduce complications and reduce complications to birth rates, what do? They said to the women, here are your notes, the midwife, the community social workers, the GP, anybody else that you come into contact with, they will all write in these notes. And lo and behold, we saw the mortality rate of women dying from complications go down because women actually looked after their notes. They thought that we couldn't trust them. But women are so good at looking after their notes. They tried this with men and it didn't work. So I think there's a lesson there. But we have to give access to patients, and I agree with that. So now with the NHS app, we trialed it with the pandemic. You can actually access some of your blood results. But I think it would be really incredible if you could access things like hospital notes and also things like x-rays, scans, what plans are made. The problem with that is that not everybody's going to be then nuanced enough to understand what that hospital information is about. And so sometimes we write something in notes as a thought, as a differential diagnosis, but the patient might think, oh my God, my diagnosis is this. And incidental or accidental findings, which mean nothing, are sometimes picked up. So again, we've got to sort of realize that what do we share that's safe for the patient to understand? And that is a really complex sort of conversation I think nationally we need to have. How much access should you have to your data and then data protection around that? And then the other thing you said was, I asked for a 10-minute appointment or a 15-minute appointment privately and I was asked to come in straight away. So I'm a private GP. I run my own private practice doing women's health as well as an NHS GP. And I'm the same person. I deliver the same care as a private doctor as I do on the NHS. But for me, the driver is time. I do the same NHS guidance. I deliver the same pathways as a private doctor. But when I see a woman, say for menopause care privately, I book myself half an hour appointment. That gives me time to catch up. That gives me time to listen to her. That means I'm not pressured because my next patient is going to be, say, a different patient. It might be a stroke patient. I have a set alone clinic where I just do women's health all day on a Friday. And I think that when you have a private doc patients, it's literally the time that they slot aside for a patient and then the payment that you get for that. So on the NHS, that time that you might have with the dentist is less. And so the payment and the funding will come from a different pot of money, whereas privately you're funding it so they can give you bigger time and they can slot that into the doctor because they have a set different diary. It's the same person. So that's usually how private care works, which is why the private care model is broken. Because you will not get better care privately. I don't agree that private medicine should be flourishing in this country. And I say that as a private doctor. And the reason being is because the joined up care that you get is far more better in the NHS sector. So say that you saw a private dentist and actually it was more complicated and you needed maxillofacial root surgery. That private doctor would have to refer you back to the NHS. So you're being no quicker, no faster. And I see that time and time again. I see a patient privately and she comes to see me with a breast lump. I say to her, you're far better going back to your NHS GP and actually going into the 2-week pathway because the private is the next doctor that you'll see is about 3 weeks away privately just to do your mammogram. And I think that's the complication, because it's the same people running the private sector and it's the same employers running the private individual, but there's no joined up care. And that's why you get different appointments at different times. I hope that answers the question that you asked me.
Very, very quickly, because I know we've got haven't got much time left. But what you say about the systems, about communication, it's a constant bugbear. I think every GP in the room will probably say the communication from hospital can be poor. So for example, your mum may have been in hospital, but we won't get a letter about it until 3 or 4 weeks later. By that time, she could have got worse, and we just haven't got that information available. And we do need joined up computer systems, because that would solve so many problems. There's a phenomenon as well called the workload shift from secondary care, and I'm sure you know about this, where doctors in a hospital say GP to do, and a lot of the times they could have done it themselves if the systems had enabled that. So we can prescribe electronically, so we can send a prescription as a GP to any pharmacy in the country. Hospitals should be able to do that too, rather than saying GP to prescribe this medicine that they themselves could prescribe. And that adds a lot of workload to general practitioners that is unseen. It's hidden work, but it's huge. We spend a lot of time dealing with requests from secondary care doctors, which they could have sorted out themselves, really, and it would give us more time to spend with our patients.
But the crazy thing is, they don't get money to do that work.
No,
so that's why it comes
back. Yeah, but we don't get money either, and I think a lot of secondary care doctors are not aware of what GPs do and how we're funded. They've never spent time in general practice, and the default is send it back to the GP.
Yeah, the worst is if, for example, they find something else in the hospital, they can't refer in the same hospital to a different speciality, because the hospital to hospital referral, there's no pot of money for that. Isn't that crazy? Yeah. Not always. So they come back to me and say, Dr. Nagat, this person actually now has a renal problem, a kidney problem. Could you refer to the kidney doctors, when the kidney doctor is literally down the corridor from the lung doctor? And that's the bureaucracy that we've got that is so draining for us doctors. But there's hope, there's good hope out there. Yeah, but we have run so over. But thank you so much for giving up your Saturday morning. It's been a real honour.
Thank you for listening. The 2025 Bradford Literature Festival programme is now live. Visit bradfordlitfest.co.uk to discover the huge range of events on offer over 10 days from the 27th of June. Don't miss out. Book your tickets now.